This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Once every 4 years, thousands of athletes from around the world converge to compete amongst each other in the spirit of sportsmanship, friendship, solidarity, and fair play. The Olympics, it's called the greatest show on earth. And as the 2016 Summer Games moves into its second week in Rio, we speak to someone who knows just what it takes to organize such an elaborate and momentous event, and what it personally means to the athletes who give it their all come the Summer Games. We speak to four-time track and field Olympic medalist and chairman of the London 2012 Organising Committee, Lord Sebastian Coe.
Bar None, BFM 89.9.
Welcome to another episode of Bar None, your weekly dose of all things sport. Good morning, I'm Audrey Raj. What an exciting week it's been at the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio. After months or even years of preparations, it's crunch time for the thousands of athletes at the Games as they display their athletic skill and competitive spirit for the world to see. With more than 300 events in 42 sports being showcased in Rio this time round, you can just imagine how complex and meticulous the organising process must have been for the Rio 2016 team. Organising the Olympic Games is like organising no other event, they will tell you, and so will all the nations and Games organising committees before them. Last October, Melissa Idris from The Morning Run interviewed Lord Sebastian Coe at the sidelines of the World Transformation Forum here in KL, where he was one of the featured speakers Pemandu brought in for the event. Seb Coe, of course, was the chairman of the London 2012 Organising Committee. He and his team managed to host one of the best games this generation has ever seen, and he shares with us the challenges and lessons learned from hosting an international sporting event of this scale.
Most great projects, it always starts with a proposition, and the proposition was one of using the games or finding a vehicle to transform the lives of young people, and the Olympic Games is a fantastic opportunity to do that. But those three people, on the eve of the Games, became an organising committee of 8,500 people, £6.5 billion going into the British construction industry at a particularly difficult time in the 2007-2008 when, you know, there was a significant global crisis. So the journey was an extraordinary journey, and it was one that people made with generosity of spirit and commitment, and it brought the nation together in an unbelievable way.
I read somewhere that some in the International Olympic Committee felt that the London Games is the template for converting a winning bid team to a well-run organising committee. What do you think other countries can learn from your success in London?
Well, those are very generous observations. I think there have been some great games. I remember the Sydney Games. Beijing was lots of different reasons and extraordinary games. The Vancouver Winter Games, absorbing a city into a sporting event. I think I probably learned a bit from as many games that I've been to as a competitor or an observer or a journalist or whatever guise I've been there in. But I do think that it was the continuity of the people. Every director that arrived to do a particular, you know, to head a functional area remained throughout the journey. We only had one chairman, we only had one chief executive, we only had one communications director, only one sports director. Everyone that got appointed stayed the 7 years. And I think the continuity of the teams really made a big difference.
Did your career as a professional athlete in track and field, did that have anything to do with your success? Because you mentioned that all the games that you've watched as an athlete and as a sports administrator, that's all kind of gone into organizing the games.
I think being a competitor, I suppose it lends you a certain experience that you can take into an organizing committee. And I say that because so much that you need to achieve in a games is really achieved on behalf of the athletes. Mm. So if you've been an athlete in a village, you know what a good village is, you know what a bad village is, you know what good service is, you know what bad service is, you know that a transportation system has to work. You have to get the athletes to their training venues on time. You need to get them to their competitive venues on time. You can't play fast and loose with an athlete that's devoted over half their young lives to that great moment and fall short on the project management. So as a competitor, I always instinctively knew what I needed as a competitor, and I tried to convert that into the vision and the delivery around the London Games. I also think, having been a Member of Parliament and a government minister, I think that also gave me an understanding of how to bring government departments and political coalitions together, because that was important as well. The sport was vital, but delivering a Games means that you are relying on a coalition of support and stakeholders. 19 government departments help deliver the Games.
Lord Sebastian Coe is a British Olympic track athlete who won 2 gold medals in the Blue Ribbon 1,500 metres event of the 1980 and 1984 Olympic Games. He also set 11 world records during his career, including the world record for the 800 metres, which stood for about 16 years. He is currently the president of the International Association of Athletics Federations, or the IAAF, a position he has held for about a year. As someone who knows the challenges of hosting 10,000 athletes for 2 weeks, Melissa Idris asked the chairman of the London 2012 Organising Committee if the Rio 2016 Games has been judged too harshly.
Delivering an Olympic Games is the toughest challenge any city undertakes. Rio have delivered a World Cup, but again, let's put that into perspective. The World Cup is one sport. It's in fixed venues with some operational challenges, but they pale into insignificance compared to simultaneously delivering 26, which in essence is over 50, world championships in the space of 2 weeks. And again, to put that into perspective, the World Cup matches in Rio, those that took place in Rio, in aggregate, totaled more than about little more than eight hours of live sport. This year, you will have nearly 10,000 hours of live sport. And that is the difference between a World Cup in a city and an Olympic Games in a city. So the first thing I always say is, this is tough. And it doesn't really matter whether it's Madrid, Tokyo, London, New York, Moscow. This will challenge a city in the way that nothing else challenges that city. Has Rio been judged a little harshly? Yes, I think on some counts it has. And again, bearing in mind that some of the legacy around the pacification of the favelas, the transportation systems that have been built, some of the lasting legacy around social housing in the village, these are all profound contributions to the city of Rio.
So personally, what will you be judging Rio on?
The athlete in me will always judge it on the service you provide for athletes. The one thing I didn't ever want was I could sit down with an athlete at the end of the London Games and say, and listen to their story. And they might have said to me, I leave elated because I won a gold medal, or I leave desolate because I didn't get out of the first round. I could listen to some that said, look, I probably should have made a semi-final, but I only made a quarter-final. Others that said they made a semi-final, got into a final, even got a medal. That sport. But what I never wanted to hear from any one of them was to say that there was something you overlooked, something you didn't do, something that you failed to put together in the project that stopped me from doing what I have spent half my life trying to train for. And so for me, I will always view that through the eyes of the athlete. Did we provide the best possible set of services for those athletes? Did we create a village that was tent coping and dealing with every one of their needs? Did we have a transport system that worked, that got them to their venues on time? Did we create volunteers that knew how to look after them and the right thing to say at the right time? Yes, I think we did. And so for me, it will always be calibrated through the service you provide athletes. They are the number one client group. You don't do it for the media. You don't do it for prime ministers.
Not even for the spectators?
Spectators are important, but the athletes are the number one.
Have you ever found that conflict within you, thinking from an athlete's point of view versus an organizer's point of view?
No, because if you get it right for the athletes, you probably get it right for at least 80% of the project. You can't build a bad village. You can't create substandard transport systems that unravel within hours of an opening ceremony. You can't deliver awful food. You can't have athletes queuing up at airports for hours and hours and hours. You have to do it. If you do it right for the athletes, you, by and large, you'll get it right for most of the project.
What would you say was your toughest decision organising the London Games?
I don't think there was any one set of circumstances that stands out. But, you know, tickets is always a challenge. You have many, many more people wanting tickets than you're able to provide. Your venues can't be limitless in size.
Because often with these major sporting events, I mean, you have to make decisions that aren't going to be popular, but you're going to have to make them on the spot.
Yeah, you sometimes, you know, I changed the course of the marathon simply because if I hadn't changed the course of the marathon, it would have caused complete traffic gridlock. But for some communities that are expecting the marathon to pass through their communities, that was a tough decision. Some of the decisions we made around tickets were tough decisions. So, you know, the nature of the project is you're making thousands of decisions every day. Not all of them are going to be popular ones.
Now, you mentioned in your keynote at the Global Transformation Forum that the Olympics is a symbol of soft power. Do you still hold to that today?
Well, if you look at the profound impact that the Olympic Games have had on nations, both internally and externally. The Games went to Moscow in 1980. I was there. You know, that was against a backdrop of the invasion of Afghanistan. Athletes, not officials, governments told us we shouldn't go. We chose to go. I think we were in the infancy of change. In Seoul in 1988, barely 50% of the world recognized South Korea at that stage diplomatically. The world went there. And actually, profoundly, the Paralympics, and this is always a story I tell, when Paralympics went to Seoul, the organizers were told by the residential property people in South Korea that if Paralympians stayed in that village, there would be no residual value in those properties on the commercial market afterwards. And yet, within a few years of that, South Korea became an exemplar in the region for disability rights. So the Paralympics had a profound impact on the communities of South Korea. If you look at recent games, North and South Korea have walked into stadiums together. It's probably the only time they've ever come together. So I can give example after example. Even in 1936, you know, the famous Jesse Owens, that act, what more better demonstrated the risible Aryan views of Adolf Hitler than Jesse Owens making a sporting and social statement in the way that he did in those games. So I think that sport has not just mirrored society, it's often set its trends.
Has the landscape of athletics changed since you were a professional athlete yourself?
Not enough of it has changed. The same format for the events, the same way we present, it's changed little. If you went into an athletic stadium 30 years ago, you'd still pretty much, you know, and you went there again today, you wouldn't see a massive change. I think we need to remember we are in sport, but our business is entertainment. And we need to reflect that. I think also we need to make sure that young people understand the values of track and field, and more importantly, that governments understand that track and field is the most accessible sport for most people. Everybody can run, everybody can jump, everybody can throw. There's a very low threshold of entry. You don't need expensive double-hulled yachts and dressage horses. And I think that our sport, track and field, is uniquely placed to help national ambitions in health and education as well.
Is that why you joined politics in the 90s? Did you feel like you wanted to change the way sports is consumed at a policy level?
No, I didn't actually go into politics for sport. I went into politics because I was fascinated by politics, and I knew I wanted to go into politics long before I went into, you know, knew that I was going to have a sporting career.
What was it about politics that fascinated you?
I don't know. I've just always been fascinated in politics. I studied economics and politics at university. I've always been politically engaged. I became a member of parliament, a minister, and a chief of staff in a political party. So it's something that's always fascinated me.
Are there similarities between the political arena and the sporting arena?
Yes, you get injuries in both, but rarely in sport are they inflicted by your own teammates. politicians come and go, leaders come and go. International sport would not have survived for as many centuries as it had if it had not been based on things that were way beyond, you know, political structures and systems, and that actually sport can help bring about change that few other areas of activity can, and that politicians often shy away from many of the things that sport shines a spotlight on.
Because sport transcends politics.
Sport transcends politics, but it also flags up discrimination, it flags up political inequity, it flags up the ability to take sport into areas where few other vehicles can produce social change. You know, sport often gets criticized for going to places where maybe, you know, we have political differences or cultural differences, but actually sport can help make those changes and are prepared to touch on issues that most politicians, for diplomatic reasons, shy away from.
Lord Coe, thank you so much for speaking with us today. It's been such a pleasure.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you.
That was Melissa Idris from The Morning Run speaking to Lord Sebastian Coe on the sidelines of the Pemandu Global Transformation Forum in Kuala Lumpur. For more on the spirit of the Olympics, or Olympism as it's called, or even what you can expect from Team Malaysia at the Games in Rio, check out our podcast at bfm.my/barnone. We leave you now with the official theme song for the London 2012 Olympics, Survival by Muse. This is Audrey Raj wishing you a sporty weekend ahead. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.